I won't let my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. In two clinical studies, Tremfya guselkumab, taken by injection, provided 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks in 7 out of 10 adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. In a study, nearly 7 out of 10 patients with 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks were still clearer at 5 years. At 1 year and thereafter, patients and healthcare providers knew that Tremfya was being used. This may have increased results. Results may vary.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now, you're multitasking. But what if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. So multitask right now. Get your quote now at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hurts, the pressure coming. Steps away. Now it's picked up. Hurts, nobody open. Hit as he throws. Wobbler over the middle. It's caught at the 5 and into the end zone for the touchdown. Olamide Zaccheaus.
14 to the Rams. Burrow in the gun. Second down, 6. Shotgun snap. Handoff to Mixon over the left tackle. Place the tackle. Turn the 5. Break the tackle at the 4. Into the end zone. Touchdown, Cincinnati. Joe Mixon.
Another Monday night, another doubleheader, sort of simultaneous, overlapping, picture-in-picture, spoiler alert, two games at once. When you have two Monday night games, you have none. Although, once the first game finally ended and full focus and attention could be devoted to the second game, Christopher, it got better. It got more enjoyable. I guess it's better that way. Like, let the crappy part of the overlapping game happen when both games are being played. Then when the first game's over, the next page in the script says, let's make the only game left a little more interesting. Because it was. I disagree with some of the things the Rams did down the stretch, but it still was a much more entertaining game than I thought it was going to be between the Rams and the Bengals, and that's where we're going to start today. It's Tuesday. It's PFT Live. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Yeah, I mean, hey, listen, I don't mind it. I like the action. I like the 7 o'clock start of the game. The one thing I don't get now is, and I'm watching both games, one's on a laptop, okay, so now the overlap starts to continue. And what I would like to tell ESPN is that I'm watching the game on the computer and it's a few seconds behind and you're showing me the game before it's actually happening for me. And I have a screen and I'm 43 and it's 2023 and I know where the other game is and I know how to flip channels and do everything. Work the internet is crazy. So like that was annoying a few times where they'd give a look in and I'm going, well, I'm kind of paying attention right here, and I missed a play now because they've already showed it, and I'm a play in front or behind there. I didn't love that, right? But other than that, it was a good viewing experience.
That was a common complaint that I noticed last night, that when they would go simultaneous two right. games, one screen, the other game would be ahead, of what people were watching.
Exactly.
If they were separately watching the game.
Right.
And that there's just, look, why do you keep saying this? Because they keep doing it. There's no reason to go simultaneous view. There's no reason. Unless this is part of some effort to bootstrap the ratings together. People have been asking me, why does ESPN and ABC
do
this? Why are they doing this? And I don't know whether they think they can get some combined rating that looks better. I just don't get it. I don't know why the NFL wants to do it. I would prefer Monday, Tuesday, or Monday, 7 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 8 o'clock. Sorry, folks on the West Coast that would have a game start at 2 in the afternoon. But I don't have a problem with two games as long as I can watch both games and as long as the broadcaster doesn't do things that make it more frustrating, not less frustrating, to have two games on at the same time. Rant over until they do it again. I think they're only doing it one more time this year.
Okay.
And one of the reasons that people should complain if you don't like it, don't just take it. Don't just shut up if you don't like it, because if enough people complain, they'll stop doing it. They'll just stop doing it. You know, they used to do 7 o'clock, 10
o'clock. I thought that would have happened after last week.
Yeah. Well, they've already got it locked in for the season.
Oh, you're talking about that part.
Once this season's experiment.
Okay, gotcha. Yes.
They'll just stop doing two games on Monday night that overlap. Let us enjoy one game at a time. After having this constant overload of information all day Sunday, which we're used to. It's the way football's always been, where you've got a bunch of games going on at once. Let us just enjoy our one game. Let us just do that. So maybe they will, maybe they won't. Doesn't matter. Last night, first game enjoyable if you're an Eagles fan. Second game enjoyable if you're a fan of football but not a Rams fan. Bengals win 19-16. And let's start there. And obviously, the big question going into the game and the one that hovered over the entirety of the preparation for the Bengals was whether or not Joe Burrow was going to play. And if he did, how would he look? And at the end of the day, he played. There's a risk that was assumed, a conscious risk. In order to avoid 0-3, they're willing to put him out there and just not have him do much that would potentially cause further injury to the calf. But the real risk, Christopher, was, that's twice now I've called you Christopher. Wait, that's three times. The real risk was he's going to make it worse. This isn't a situation where it's like, oh, he can't do anything to make it worse. No, he can. He can make it worse. And he's out there playing. I was surprised at the end of the day that they went through with it. And my guess is Burrow really wanted to do it.
That's
and when
right.
you're just giving the guy a huge pile of money, and he wants to play, who are you to tell him not to play?
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge game. He feels the pressure of that situation. He does. As a competitor, of course you do. And of course, he's pretty aware of the backup quarterback situation that's kind of underwhelming there in Cincinnati as well. So there's a lot of things, I think, that play into that. And then, yes, being a MVP candidate, being on a team that's supposed to be a legit Super Bowl contender, and the fact of the pressure of, oh, my gosh, we could start 0-3, and, man, that's going to be a big mountain to climb back up of. So, yeah, it's what you talk about all the time. It's guys, they want to play. That pressure is used against them and usually by themselves, just in the fact that they want to compete and be great and whatever else. So, hey, that's where you start. You're just happy that he didn't get hurt again, re-injure it, right? I'm sure it's going to be sore a little today. He's not totally normal. You could tell by that. He was reluctant to move. You could tell he was even reluctant to push off that leg sometimes real aggressively, even to throw a ball and put a little extra mustard or oomph on it. So this is something he's going to have to manage, I don't want to say the short-term future. It's probably going to be the next 4, 5, 6 weeks we're going to see stuff like this on his leg when he's off the field in the sideline. And just, good for football and good for all of us that he stayed healthy and, hopefully they can keep it going.
But see, that's the challenge. It can only heal so much between games. No matter what you do between games, and it's going to limit his practice time. It's going to limit the offense.
Yep.
It's going to make them not more predictable per se. It's just less that Joe Burrow can do. So what will defenses do now? They're not going to be worried about Joe Burrow moving out of the pocket or running the ball so you can deploy your 11 defenders in a way that takes into account this guy's not going to try to do anything like what we would see from Patrick Mahomes or Josh Allen. And from time to time, we see just like that nifty little sudden quick movement. Burst to the left, burst to the right,
yeah,
run if the lane's
there. He's a slippery SOB, as I like to say. Right, yeah.
you don't have to worry about that now. He's not slippery.
Right.
He's not slippery because he can slip and slide right into a serious calf injury if he pushes it too far. How much can it heal? How much will it heal? Especially when you got now a short turnaround for their game against the Titans this weekend. Let's have a listen to Burrow on balancing that risk of re-injuring, aggravating, making it worse versus avoiding an 0-3 start to the season. Here he is.
All the stuff that you weigh when you're making that decision, do you know, there is risk to go out there and potentially re-injure it, but there's also a risk to go out there and be 0-3. So I wanted to be out there for my guys, and, you know, I was confident that I would be able to do what I needed to get the win. You go 0-3, not only, you know, obviously a lot of football left to be played, but 0-3 sounds a lot worse than 1-2, and morale is probably a lot lower when you're 0-3. So this is a big win for us. Good to get on the board. I think we'll be able to put some together now.
You know when morale's lower than 0-3? When you're 1-2 and your quarterback has a ruptured Achilles tendon. That's when morale is lower. And I'm not suggesting that that's one of the risks that Joe Burrow is assuming, but it's all down in that same area. So if you do play and you do make it worse, and you're out for several weeks, and even if you somehow win the game, it's a much different vibe. And they ultimately know what they're doing, but Chris, you've said this time and again, the level of medical expertise for the average NFL team, not what most of us would think it is. And there are some things that happen, decisions that get made that would suggest that you know, maybe this isn't the ideal situation. Maybe this isn't the right decision. Maybe we're not doing the accurate and the thing that's in the best interest of the player long-term or the team, frankly. Sometimes you just roll the dice and you go. And I feel like there was an element of that with the Bengals. An element of, we're just going to roll the dice and go and see what happens. And there were a couple of moments where they're like, you know, did he step funny? Did he get kicked? Because he's going to be out there in the fray while he's playing through this thing and trying to make it better. And as Jake Glazer was explaining it on Sunday, he did say it's a serious injury. It's not some minor little thing. Like, he's got a real calf injury that isn't just going to magically disappear. It's going to take time for it to heal. And if he's playing, it's going to take longer. So this is something that's going to hover over the Bengals at least until their bye week, which is coming up after the next three games.
Yeah.
And then after that, it's still going to be a question because re-injury is going to be – I think there's a good chance it's just an all-year thing for the Bengals.
Yeah, hopefully you could get to the bye week without re-aggravating it significantly, get to the bye week, have a week off completely, be careful getting ready for that next game after the bye week, and you could go, well, it's about as close as to 100% as you can be here down the stretch. And, you know, like you said, it's tricky injury, so you got to be careful. You know, he referenced it there. Yeah, the 0-3 thing in an NFL locker room, it's real. I mean, that's when you really feel the building stinks when you're 0-2. When you're 0-2, it's like, oh, no, we don't know what winning feels like. We haven't tasted that. And everybody feels the pressure in the building. And you could feel it coming from the coaches in the front office. And as a player, you feel their pressure. And it makes everything more intense. So he was very aware of that, as he said there. And then on top of that, I think we're talking about, hey, it's the AFC. Hey, oh, Cleveland's pretty real. We lost to them. Hey, Baltimore, we know they're going to be good and in this in the end. Oh, we lost to them too. So I think there's the fear of falling too far behind. And that and they'd like to, I think, play one of these AFC championship games at home and have Kansas City or somebody else come visit them one time. So I think all of that played into what we saw last night. And, of course, it wasn't pretty. I mean, you can't sit there and go, oh, it was pretty. Like, hey, I give them a lot of credit. It ain't easy to play and even be as good as he was when you don't practice all week. You haven't really practiced all training camp, right? But at the same time, it doesn't look like the Joe Burrow we know, like when he's 100% healthy. That was like, just get it done, Joe Burrow. And then I added on top of that, you see the offense last night. You know, the offense, it's okay. We got something going. But, I mean, I'm not ready to, like, write home and be like, oh, whoa, watch out. The big play Bengals are back 49 dropbacks and 259 yards. Whoa, 65 yards rushing by the running back. Uh-oh, they're back. No, I mean, think about the telecast, Mike. I mean, the offense needs to do more. We watched the Dolphins on Sunday, and you go, look at that. Does that look like anything that's creative, what we saw last night, right? And that's where it's got to pick up. I mean, Orlovsky did a segment on, look, they moved Chase to the left and then to the right, and then they put him in the slot. And it's like, that's big news for the Bengals, but for the rest of football, it's like, duh, like you're supposed to do that. And you're supposed to move them around a whole bunch more. So they got some work to do still on that side of the ball because it wasn't pretty last night, and they were supposed to beat the Rams at home.
Burrow was very efficient early in the game. He was like 9 for 12 at one point, but they weren't really moving the ball in big chunks.
Right.
Then things started to sputter, and there was some groaning, not quite some of the booing that we've heard from other fan bases at halftime of these games where the offense isn't doing what the home team's fans think that it should, but you could get a sense that there was kind of like some
restlessness
in Cincinnati.
Definitely. Yeah.
And then it all just kind of woke up. And one of the reasons it woke up, and one of the reasons they even had a chance to wake it up, the defense – played incredibly well last night. The Rams could get nothing done in the red zone. They were 0 for 10 at one point on third downs. They eventually converted one to end up 1 for 11 on the night. But the defense really saved the day by throttling the Rams repeatedly when they got close to getting a touchdown. There you see a sack on first and goal from the 4. They end up with a field goal there. And all night long, Matthew Stafford. And you know what? When I saw Matthew Stafford on the sideline after the game, and I'm a firm believer that he never says much about when he's hurt, when he's hurting, what's hurting. He processes it. He deals with it. Last night felt like one of those nights that he's going to be a little bit different moving forward. I'm not going to know why. Well, it's because he's nursing one or two or three different injuries that no one knows about, including the team. It just felt like one of those nights that we saw it against the Seahawks. Stafford's healthy. Holy crap. Once Stafford starts getting banged up, that's when it starts to go the other way. And I just feel like last night may have laid the foundation for that. We'll see how he plays going forward. But he got banged around hard last night, repeatedly last night, by that Bengals defense, to the point where it just felt like, and it was getting really loud too. You could see the Rams weren't processing in the second half. And you know, third and long. Draw play. Third and long, draw play. They weren't even trying to get guys open down the field because they weren't going to have time.
Exactly
right. Because that defensive front was swallowing up the Rams blockers, a theme that dates back to last year.
Exactly. That's standard protocol for Matthew Stafford's life right now, dating back to last year, like you said. I mean, last week was assault by the 49ers. If they can't get the ball out quick and find little ways to Pakua Nakua and Atwell and whatever else and get the ball 5, 8, 10 yards, and then every now and then, like you saw last night, they catch you in a defense where you're worried about stopping some of those shorter intermediate routes, right? And then, boom, okay, we hit 2-2 Atwell down the field. But, you know, that's few and far between. They can't do it consistently. Why? I mean, one, they can't run the ball, so nobody's scared of that. Two, like you said, they can't create enough time back there to give a guy like Matthew Stafford, who has still an incredible arm, to make anything happen there. But, like, you know, that's the bright spot of the night, for the Bengals at least, the fact that their D. Yeah, their D has, of course, got some big-time potential. We know that D-line's good. Those linebackers are good. They got two, you know, they got some young guys in the secondary who I don't know have played their best the first 2 weeks, but they played damn good last night. We saw Dax Hill on that safety there. So that's the positive thing. And they're going to need that. The defense is going to have to continue to play like that because I don't look at it and go, ooh, they're close to turning the corner here and getting back to the big play. Bengals are explosive. Like, it was a nice start. There's something positive there. Sure. But – you know, again, I think you go through a lot of houses in America right now and you'd go, name me one other guy on the defense other than Aaron Donald for the Rams. And people would go, right. So I'm not ready to anoint the Rams like the Rams Super Bowl 79 defense here yet or anything like that either. But this Bengals defense, it's got a chance to be really, really damn good. We know that. And they're going to have to hold down the fort just to help Joe Burrow heal and get this offense kind of get their feet underneath them here as the season goes along.
They really did overwhelm the Rams' offensive line. I think by the time Joe Noteboom ended up back at left tackle, it was Trey Hendrickson versus Noteboom, and it was ugly. And
it was ugly.
And it was
right.
Like he had no chance to even stop Trey Hendrickson, and Matthew Stafford had no time to do anything. I want to focus on one thing, though. Well, before we do that, let's check the box so we can say we let you hear from someone other than us. Bengals coach Zach Taylor praising the Bengals defense after last night's 19-16 win over the Rams.
Game well. It starts really with the defense. The defense set the tone first in the first half while the offense was trying to get their feet underneath them. And so to hold them to, 6 points at halftime, I think it was, and then allow the offense to go out and start to get some momentum and play with a two-score lead, that's the type of football game we're used to playing. Our defense kept us right in this thing. And 1-11 on third downs, the two interceptions, five or six sacks, that was outstanding. The run defense I thought was outstanding as well, which you know, is understated because it forces them into the situations they got to throw it, and that's where you get the pressure. So I thought Lou did a great job dialing up pressures at the right time that put these guys in good position, and that was a great job by our defense today.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's what the Bengals are going to need as Joe Burrow continues to heal this calf injury on the fly. The defense needs to play well, and the balanced teams are the ones that tend to find the most success over the long haul. You got to have an offense that gets it done. You got to have a defense that steps up. And to your point on the offense, they did use a lot of Ja'Marr Chase last night. He had his biggest game of the season. But you're right. Is it some sort of revolution? The clouds part, the stone tablets are handed down from on high, that you're moving your best player, one of the best receivers in football, around?
Right.
Of course you move him around.
Right.
He's one of the best players in football. You don't just line him up out left and say run a go route every play. You use him in different ways because he gets open, he makes the catch, and then he makes things happen once he has the ball in his hands. So I agree with you. It's like they acted like the Bengals discovered plutonium last night. They just opened their eyes.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, yeah, I wasn't trying to make fun of Dan Orlovsky or anything like that. I was making fun of the fact that he had to point that out himself. He was right to point it out because the Bengals don't do any of that. I'm pointing it out because, yeah, it's like, come on, what are you talking about? Tyreek Hill, we watch him every week. He's running around, moving around. They stack him. They put him in a bunch. He does a cartwheel. He goes in motion. I mean, he does everything. You watch Bengals film, mostly it's Ja'Marr Chase just sitting there like you're talking about, outside. And then, okay, so they move him around. They got then good. I mean, that's a start there. And, of course, it created some matchups and got him the ball in space a little bit and got the offense and some rhythm going there. So that's the positive thing. But they're still way too good and too talented to be like for us to be having these conversations. That's where it's just got to go up another level, in my opinion, if they want to win the Super Bowl. I mean, that's what they're trying. I think they're holding themselves to that standard. I mean, it can't be just the Ja'Marr Chase show, which 12 for 141 is nice, right? But again, it doesn't like blow your doors off for the one of the most explosive receivers in football. But within that, every piece of energy was exhausted to get him the ball, and they can't get T. Higgins or Tyler Boyd the ball after that. So that's where, just to me, the offense has to continue to push itself there. It is hard when your quarterback's not playing and starting there. And like you said, it's going to have to be on that defense here to hold it down, which they did a great job last night.
Around any corner, within every battle, and with the dawn of each new day, the threat of the unexpected, the unpredictable, and the unrelenting lies in wait. But Marines will always be there. They are the constant in the chaos. No matter the battlefield, Marines adapt to win, defeating every shifting threat, protecting our nation's future. The few, the proud, the Marines.
I won't let my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. In two clinical studies, Tremfya guselkumab, taken by injection, provided 90% clear skin at 16 weeks in 7 out of 10 adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. In a study, nearly 7 out of 10 patients with 90% clear skin at 16 weeks were still clearer at 5 years. At 1 year and thereafter, patients and healthcare providers knew that Tremfya was being used. This may have increased results. Results may vary.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
I need to issue a mild correction of what you just said. They did get T. Higgins the ball. The problem is,
well,
he was Chubbs last night.
He was a little Chubbs last night. He definitely was. He had a rough night. Certainly, like, I mean, what was it, 2-3 blatant drops, right? I mean, it was in his own head. But this is where I'll go back, and this is to me, because as you're watching the game, I'm going, well, damn, yeah. I mean, he doesn't see the ball for periods of times. He didn't see the ball much in 2 weeks. They're all out of whack. They're out of whack. And then you want to add on top of that that he probably didn't get to catch a football from Joe Burrow all week either until pregame warmups. So that's where, you know, there's a lot of work to be done there. And like you said, the defense early on holding the Rams out of the end zone and making them kick short field goals, that was really one of the big parts of the game. And Zach Taylor alluded to it, that game didn't get, oh, Rams up 14-0, and now the offense really has pressure on them to make some plays and do some things there. The Bengals D saved the day.
Think of the difference in the mindset, Chris, if the Rams had managed to get a two-score lead.
They don't call 2-2 out, well, out of bounds,
who's a
right?
statue.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you've got a quarterback who's a statue. You've got Aaron Donald and others coming after him. That thing, that's how 40-0 happens, folks. 40-0 doesn't mean that this team that won is dramatically better and in a different stratosphere of the sport than the other. It's just a couple of things happen early, and then the dam breaks because it becomes much easier to defend that offense. That's where the Bengals ended up with their defense once they got the two-score lead, and the Rams couldn't do anything, and Stafford couldn't get away from the pressure, and they couldn't keep the pressure away from him. That's what would have happened to Joe Burrow. He would have had no time to do anything, but they hung around. They found some spark in the running game. Joe Mixon's numbers, as you said, weren't great, 65 yards, but he was running hard purpose, effectively getting first downs.
Yep.
There was one play where he just kind of willed his way. There were a couple times where he willed his way to a first down, scored that touchdown on second and third effort. That's what the Bengals needed to have a complete team effort in order to win the game. Here's the second and sixth play that just popped for the touchdown. He had other just kind of hard-nosed runs, guy who just kind of bulled into the line and pushed the pile and got to where he needed to be. That's what helped the Bengals with no touchdown passes last night from Joe Burrow. Look, I don't know how much stock to put in the passer rating stat, but it's the only stat that's been around for as long as I've been following football to give us an idea of what a quarterback is doing. And it used to be that 80 or 90 was pretty good. Now all the good quarterbacks are over 100, over 110. Frankly, Joe Burrow last night was 59.8.
No
touchdown passes, one reception. It's a combination of completion percentage, yards per attempt, touchdown percentage based upon your number of throws, and interception percentage based on your number of throws. And they put it in a formula and they give you a number. 59.8 is bad. That's bad for an NFL quarterback today. As it relates to his overall passing efficiency for the night, he distributed the ball. They made things happen. They woke up after a slow start, but you take away that mobility, that threat of moving around, that ability to extend plays, and he's not the guy that he ordinarily is. So good for the Bengals to have that total team effort and get the win over the Rams. Before I pivot to something I want to say about the Rams, I got a funny email from our good friend Mary, the Eagles fan who lives in Atlanta.
Oh, yeah.
She's upset we didn't do our 10 minutes of BS at the top of the show. Hey, blame it on ESPN and the NFL for giving us two games that we have to talk about. We got a lot to do. This is one of those 10 pounds of crap in a 5-pound bag show. So we didn't have time to BS. I barely had time to make that point. Okay. What did you think of fourth quarter, just over 6 minutes left? Rams have 4th and 5 in their own territory, and they're down 10, and they punt. To me, that's the old, let's not make this look worse than it's going to look in the newspaper move, where 19-9 could become 22-9 or 26-9 if you just give them the ball back there because you don't have faith in your offense to gain the 5 yards. So you punt.
Yeah.
And I mean, because at the end of the day, what it comes, hey, they got the touchdown. Well done. All right. You showed that you can score a touchdown. But they can't who can recover an onside kick? If you're going to pin your hopes on an onside kick recovery, you're already screwed because the chances of that working out, the Rams, they said last night, haven't recovered an onside kick in 11 years. And this new rule that they put in a few years ago, and they try to tweak it. It's too hard to recover an onside kick. That should not be part of your analytics process. You have the ball down 10 with 6 minutes left. It's 4th and 5. Whatever the formulas tell you, whatever you think is the right thing to do, if the other option is, well, we can still score, get an onside kick, and score again, just throw that one away. Because you ain't getting the onside kick recovery. It's not happening. You got the ball 4th and 5. You're down 10. You got enough time to score and get the ball back. If you can stop them once, do that. Well, that was my thought. What did you think when they decided to punt? But down 10 with 6 minutes left.
All right. So when it happened, I was sitting there going, okay, wait, are they going to go for it here, 4th and 5? I mean, the offense, as we know, had really sputtered at that moment, right? They weren't capable of doing anything there for, I don't know, it felt like at least a quarter and a half to that point where you went, man, they got nothing going on at all. Like you said just a few minutes ago, they couldn't protect him at all. They couldn't run. Tutu Atwell big plays had disappeared. You could tell that wasn't going to happen. So I thought, okay, wait, are they going to go for it? And then, you know, if they don't get it, just go, hey, I hope we can hold them to a field goal and it'd still be 22-19 there. Well, okay, they did that, but they probably looked at it there and just said, well, what's the chances of now us scoring 2 touchdowns to try to win the football game? So I think they took the approach of, hey, wait, our defense has been pretty good tonight. Their offense, it ain't been pretty. We've been close a few times, tipping passes and things, and the ball's got in the air, and we didn't intercept it. So I think they looked at it and said, let's see if our defense can make one more stand here and maybe make a play or whatever, and we could get the ball back and maybe score quickly, and Stafford can make a big throw and maybe have a little wiggle room. But, yeah, you're still going to have to kick that onside kick because if I remember correctly, right, they had one more timeout still when they punted that ball? Maybe I'm wrong.
Yes.
Yeah, right?
They had one left. More. One left.
Right. So I'm guessing.
All the more reason to keep the ball.
Yeah.
You've got the ball. It's 4th and 5. It's not 4th and 15. It's 4th and 5. That's a makeable down. For first down.
It is.
You're the Rams, Sean McVay,
sure.
High-powered offense, greatest show on turf 2.0. I know they don't have, and I'm being sarcastic because they're not what they were 2 years ago, but it's 4th and 5. And we saw what happened. It worked. The plan worked. Oh, we'll hold the Bengals. We'll get the ball back. We'll score a touchdown. And now all we need is the onside kick. But you can't pin your hopes on recovering an onside kick. I'd rather go for it 4th and 5. That's my point. Okay. If I go for it and I keep this drive alive and I score, I don't have to rely on an onside kick. I can get a stop and get the ball back and try to tie the game. Versus, all right, we're going to give them the ball back. They're going to take some time off the clock. We only got one timeout. There isn't much we can do. We get the ball back. We have enough time to maybe get a touchdown, onside kick, field goal, overtime. Yeah, all makes sense. Except you ain't recovering the onside kick. So keep the frickin' ball at 4th and 5. Go all in there. It just makes me think Sean McVay and the Rams did not want to have it become 26-9. And it feels like you got your ass kicked at 26-9. And they ended up with 19-16. Looks like a close game. Doesn't look bad. Almost covered the spread. And didn't even have to kick a meaningless field goal with 4 seconds left to do it. So I feel like there's a lot. And what a shock. Perception is reality in Los Angeles, where Hollywood is. I just feel like there was some of that fugazi, let's try to bake a better final score versus let's try to win the game. And maybe they just thought there's no way we're going to win anyway. So this other strategy at least gives us a chance to keep it closer than letting the Bengals score another touchdown. I mean, I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole, but to me, I think that's the only explanation, because pinning your hopes to an onside kick is foolish.
Yeah, it is. It's tough this day and age. I mean, it is. You're right. It changes the dynamic. I don't look at it and go, it's an egregiously bad decision. You know, like I said, I could see the logic in it. But like, yeah, it's predicated on them making a quick stop, getting the ball and scoring or putting points on the board quickly, you know, and that's what it's predicated on. And, you know, hey, the stop and get a turnover, whatever, I can understand your logic and wanting to ride the defense there. Now, you know, are we going to score quickly and do something off of that? That's a whole nother conversation, which we had seen that there was, you know, not, it wasn't very easy to do for the Rams there. So yeah, in modern day football, I would have been like you, I think, when it comes down to it. I would have probably been like, yep, we got to go for it here. It's go time. Who cares if it's 26-9? And you try to make something happen because, yeah, like you were saying, with the way the onside kick rules are set up, it's really tough. Or here's the other thing that I was kind of thinking too as they were getting along. Like when you only have one timeout left and you're getting close to the 2-minute warning. Here's the other thing at times where, okay, you know, the onside kick thing's a real issue like you're talking about. Kick a field goal. Instead of wasting all the time to get down inside the five and do all that, like sometimes I think you just go, hey, let's just knock three of the points off right now. We'll kick the ball off. We got the 2-minute warning. We still got a timeout, and we might get the ball back with a minute and 20 seconds left and then try to do something. That was the other thing that came to my mind as I was watching the end of the game, Mike.
Hey, that was part of the word salad that McVay offered up last week when he was finally asked about kicking a meaningless field goal that covered the spread against the 49ers. And that was one of our biggest stories of the week based upon traffic and video views and whatnot. The idea that they were down 10, the spread was 7.5, 4 seconds left, they kicked the field goal. He said, well, we were in the mindset that we were going to kick the field goal, do the onside kick, and try to score a touchdown. And I don't know, at some point his brain short-circuited and he decided to kick the field goal anyway when he knew there was no way to get the ball back. But that was part of the mindset. He was going to take the field goal. And, you know, Chris, that could have been the plan last night until they hit the long throw to Puka Nacua that sets them up first and goal on the doorstep. Because at that point, you just could have brought out Brett Maher and taken the three, right?
Well, yeah.
Instead of burning off more clock, take the three and onside kick it then.
Well, this is where I was thinking right here.
Hinges.
Yes, right. That was the moment I thought about when they went 4th and 3 and scrambled, and I went, huh, I might think about kicking the field goal there. If we could rewind it, guys, just real quick, if you don't mind, to the play where he scrambles on 4th and 3, a little bit more than this right here. There we go. This is perfect. Right? So here, this is what it crossed my mind. Oh, okay. And I know this
isn't
easy.
That's a 57-yarder, though.
Well, he slid.
That's a 57-yarder.
He slid to the 30-yard line. That would have been a 47-yarder.
No. Wait. So you meant right after
the 4th and 3.
Spike it, clock it. Wait. Hang on. You're saying after the 4th and 3 or before the 4th and 3?
No, after the 4th and 3. Yes. After the 4th and 3, you got it. Now he slides with 2 minutes and 30-something seconds left, clock the ball, kick the field goal. Okay, I know it's going to be a 48-yarder. It's not going to be easy. And then let's kick the ball off and use the 2-minute warning and the timeout. See, right here, this is what I'm talking about, Mike. All right, so he slides to about the 32. No. That's where I started to
It'd
think
have
about it.
It'd been a 50-yarder.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense. That makes sense. But again, what does it all hinge on? Recovering an onside kick, which your organization hasn't done in 11 years, which no one has done successfully so far this season, because in the efforts to make the kickoff safer, they have made it harder to recover onside kicks. And really, 4th and 15 play, these are moments where the 4th and 15, if you truly root for the team that's trailing to have a chance to win, which is what Roger Goodell admitted a decade ago, that's who he roots for, the team that's trailing, you come up with an easier way for that team to pull off what we're talking about. You're down 10, there isn't much time left, you're limited on timeouts, you got to get 3, then 7, or 7, then 3. The onside kick is not a good plank in that strategy.
No, and you can't. You can't think of the big onside kick. Ball. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah, you can't. But we're still wired.
Yeah, to think that way.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can recover the onside kick, and then we look at the numbers. Well, but there's still a chance. There's still a chance. Maybe we'll recover it this time. And then they do the onside kick last night, and the thing didn't even. It did. It was like, under what circumstances was that kick going to be recovered? And I know it's not easy to do, but when that's your only job and the kickers are just hanging around practice, wouldn't you be doing everything you could to perfect the onside kick? And maybe there's nothing you can do. Maybe that's the reality. You can't control this oblong ball that has a mind of its own. You just hope for the best. You hope you're going to get a good bounce. You hope it's going to carom off someone's shoulder pads, and you're just going to get lucky. But it just kind of proves my point. You're pinning your hopes to luck. You're pinning your hopes to pulling a needle out of the haystack when you had the ball, 4th and 5, 6 minutes left, and you could have maintained that drive, and you could have just kicked off, stopped the Bengals, if you were able to, like they did after they punted, get the ball back and try to tie it up or maybe even win the game. That, to me, is the more rational approach. And I can't help but wonder whether or not Sean McVay at some level was concerned about how 26-9 would look versus, hey, maybe even if this doesn't fully work out, the final score will be 19-16, and that looks a little bit better. It doesn't look like I got my ass.
I don't think so there. There are coaches.
There are coaches who are thinking, man. Well,
damage control is a part of this. Yeah,
score a touchdown.
Yeah, damage control is always a real thing. I don't think Sean McVay was thinking that at that moment. I think
he just made a bad decision.
I think he made a bad decision. I think
he should have kept possession.
Again, I think he's thinking, yeah, I'm going to punt it. They're going to go 3 and out, and we're going to get the ball back in the next, you know, minute and a half. And unfortunately for them, like 3 minutes or a little less than 3 minutes went off the clock. And, yeah, that put them in a really tough spot.
Well, they had one timeout left.
I know.
They only had one timeout. What are you going to do?
No.
They're going to run the ball.
It's limited. I think they were hoping that maybe they could make a play, get them behind the chains, maybe get them to throw a pass on one of the plays to where they could create a completion and do it that way. That would be what I would be guessing is their logic is. But that's, again, it's tough.
And then, it's all premised on recovering an onside kick. That's the point. We need to get past this idea that we're going to have an analytics-based strategy that hinges on recovering an onside kick, because the onside kicks are not going to be recovered. Look at that thing.
But if they get the stop and get it quick,
middle of the night.
If they get a stop and get something quick or somewhat quick and get points before the 2 minute warning, he's thinking maybe I don't have to kick an onside kick and I got the 2 minute warning and a timeout. But yeah, it's far fetched. But also, what was bad on top of that?
He got the ball 4th and 5. Keep the ball.
That we didn't hit on too is when they get down to the 3-yard line, you can't run the ball on first down either. That was another part where you're going, what the game's ticking away here. We you can't run the ball at all. They make the play to Tua Nakua, and they run the ball off the middle. That was kind of egregiously wrong as well. But hey, the Rams, they battle. We know that they played tough. They're not as good as the Cincinnati Bengals. They're surprising me in the fact of how competitive they've been, really, as a 1-2 football team. It's been impressive. It has. And, that certainly can be questioned. There's no doubt about it. In 2023 football, in that situation, to all the things you laid out, and then, of course, the rules being the way they are and how much they favor the offense and everything anyways, yeah, you go for it in that situation, 19-9, 6 minutes left. If you really want to have a think, you got a legit chance to win the football game with one timeout left. Yeah, I think what you're saying is still the right play.
Even if they kicked the field goal after that first down run by Stafford,
yeah,
it was going to require an onside kick recovery because they had no timeouts at that point. The 2 minute warning was, and I mean, maybe they would have gotten the goal back like the Raiders did the other night with 10 seconds left or something like that. And what can you do with that when the defense has already put the clamps on you? You're not going to go 80 yards in 10 seconds. But I'm looking at this now on the next play. And, you got to be getting your plays off faster than this. They get that first down, and
they still had a timeout
20
there.
20 seconds until the next play?
Yeah,
No, they'd already used the timeout. They used the timeout after the third down on the Rams drive, excuse me, on the Bengals drive after the punt. They had to use the third timeout there because the Bengals were milking the clock, right?
No. They used the timeout number three when Joe Burrow kneeled the first time at the end of the game. That was the first time.
Okay, you're right. Yeah, they still had one. They could have used it then.
Yeah.
Because I'm looking at this. They took a sack after Stafford scrambled for the first time.
That hurt it. Yeah.
And that play started with 2:21. They did not get another playoff before the 2-minute warning. Mm-hmm. And that it just they were trying to thread. Our point here is in belaboring this, because look, these decisions are made in the moment, in the crucible, real time. There's only so much you can plan for it ahead of time. But it just I didn't see the path out of the maze.
I hear you.
Once they waved the white flag with 6 minutes left and punted when they still had the ball, fourth down and five. You know, we have this revolution of going for it on fourth down because the analytics support this and support that. And we're still factoring into the broader approach to the game the possibility of recovering an onside kick, which doesn't work. It's broken. It doesn't work. Why are you relying upon that in your formulation of a strategy to come back and win? Forget about the onside kick. That's the last ditch, break glass in event of emergency option, and the glass isn't going to break. And if it does, it's just a fluke. That's where it is. Recovering an onside kick at this point is a fluke, period. All right, let's take a break. There was another game last night that did not come down to an onside kick. The Philadelphia Eagles went down to Tampa Bay in a battle of unbeaten teams, and the Eagles looked the best they have all year long. We'll break down Eagles Bucks when PFT Live continues right after this.
We're not going to be playing our best football until we get going into the season. We still got things to work on. We still got growth to do. If you're truly in the mindset of getting better every day, right? If you're truly in that mindset of getting better every day, which I know that we are on this team, you're going to continue to rise, and you're going to keep getting better. And so, you know, are we playing our best offensive football right now? No, but we shouldn't be. We shouldn't be yet.
Nick Sirianni, head coach of the Philadelphia Eagles. The team had looked a little sluggish. They still won their first two games. Last night, they were not as sluggish, although there were moments where Jalen Hurts was not as sharp as the Jalen Hurts we saw last year. It didn't matter. They overpowered the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and won the game 25-11. There were only three unbeaten teams left through 3 weeks. How about that?
It's crazy.
Dolphins, 49ers, Eagles. That's it.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about this later in the program. I mean, everybody in New York is losing their minds about the Jets. There are 15 teams that are 1-2 or worse right now, and the Jets are 1-2. So it could be worse, but not much worse. And most of the teams, not most, but almost half of the teams in the NFL are in that same boat. So only three, less than 10% of the entire league is undefeated, and the Eagles are one of them. And it does still feel like they've got work to do to get to where they were last year. Last year, they had that team of destiny vibe. This year, it's not quite there yet. But as Sirianni said, it's early in the season. You know, teams have surely game-planned ways to try to slow down Jalen Hurts. And the test is going to be, how do they perform as the season continues to unfold, Chris?
Yeah, that's right. And hey, we can't forget one huge factor in all of this. That Shane Steichen moved on. And Shane Steichen is a hell of a coach. As we're seeing, he's 2-1 with the Colts. I mean, so that's not easily replaced. I think that, you know, and Troy Aikman made that point last night, you know, that we can't forget that. The guy's a really good offensive mind. He's one of the best in football. So, you know, they got a new play caller there that's trying to find his way and his own formula, and he's learning on the fly of how he wants to tie plays together. It is an art form as far as calling plays like that. You know, we talk about it a lot, right? Just, hey, making things look the same that are different. The window dressing, how to play with the defense's mind and set something up. And, hey, here, look at this, look at this, look at this. Oh, we fake this, and then we do this. You know, I think they're finding their way that way. And, yeah, Jalen Hurts hasn't been his best through 3 weeks. But damn, oh, damn, damn. I mean, are they the most physically imposing team that I can remember in a long time? I mean, yes. It's unbelievable what we watch with the Philadelphia Eagles on a weekly basis. It's they've surpassed the early 90 Cowboys in the fact of they could just go, we're going to run it, and we're going to run the same play, and we're just going to keep doing it and doing it and do it, and you know we're going to do it, and we're still going to kick your ass and blow you off the ball. And DeAndre Swift, you know, like Troy Aikman and Joe Buck were talking about it one night, he must have been like, holy crap, these holes are unbelievably big. I mean, I've never seen a team that can physically win the battle on both sides of the line of scrimmage to the extent the Philadelphia Eagles. The 49ers are up there with their D-line. We know their O-line's real good, but it's not like this O-line. This O-line literally can run the same three plays like all game long and go, so what? We know you know what running play we're going to run. We're still going to kick your ass. That's to me where the Eagles are really special. And when the game gets tough, they just physically whoop you, and there's nothing you can do. And they basically whooped the Bucs D into a corner who kind of held strong early on and kept them out of the end zone and did a good job, you know, not letting the whole thing blow up there early on. But there's only so much you can do when your offense stinks and doesn't do well, and then you're on the field against that group, you know, every four plays like they were last night. I'm just amazed by the Eagles' physical dominance on both sides of the line of scrimmage. It's really impressive. It really is.
25-11 paints one picture. 472 yards to 174 paints a
That's
very
a better,
different picture.
Right.
It's amazing. It was as close as it was. The Buccaneers kind of got things going and had that late touchdown drive. You take that away, and it really was a blowout. And many thought, and I thought, the Bucs would keep it close. The Eagles had just been like something was missing.
Yep.
You know, they let the Patriots hang around after they got up by two scores. The Vikings, they let them hang around after the Eagles got up by two scores. And, you know, you learn. We have to have that killer instinct. We have to slam the door. We have to make it decisive so there is no opportunity for the team that we are better than to come back and try to beat us. And as you said, this is a continuation of a very favorable early season schedule.
Woo.
That allows them to kind of work their way toward full speed ahead and get themselves ready for the meat of the schedule, which is coming later. They can keep piling up win after win after win, and they're going to need it because the Cowboys are better, notwithstanding what they did on Sunday in Arizona, and the 49ers are the team that I think the Eagles need to be eyeballing.
That's right.
As the biggest threat to whatever they hope to do this year. And there you see back-to-back weeks, 49ers and Cowboys with that Cowboys
game. Got the Dolphins in week seven on NBC. Yeah, on Sunday Night Football, too. That's going to be a dandy.
Well, that one, you know, that one is getting better and better with each passing week. We've got Cowboys 49ers week five, and then we've got that one week seven. There's a couple of really good ones coming up where we're going to find out what these teams are all about. So we're finding out that the Eagles are still the team they were last year. It's just taking them a little while to get there. That physicality, though, shines through both sides of the ball. Jalen Carter had a big night last night on defense.
Yep.
The defense was just smothering. I mean, the safety, where they just completely devoured Rashad White, like he didn't even have a chance to get out of the end zone. Usually you see an NFL offense, when you get in that position and they run the ball, 99 out of 100 times the guy gets out of the end zone. He didn't even have a chance. If the line was a yard or two back, he's not getting out. They were all over him.
They are as impressive as any team I can remember in the history of football. I'm not saying that like lightly. I'm really not. You know me. They are as impressive up front on both sides of the ball as some of the all-time great football teams. That's just how I feel. And I think we see it. We saw what they did last year. They're seeing what they're doing here this year. I mean, you know me, I like legs and butts, and I mean, they're the kings of legs and butts. They got more legs and butts coming into the game on the defensive line. Like, oh, look at these four. Holy crap. Look at this. God, the football god built them in a lab. Whoa, look at the next four. Another god built them in a lab. I mean, it's incredible. And then you couple that with the offensive line, but you're right, you don't see that happen much like that, where it's just like, usually it's like, ooh, did he get out of the end zone or did he not? It's close. I'm not sure. I mean, it was a mauling there. And it was a mauling throughout the game on both sides. And that's where they're really special, and they put you in a tough spot on both sides too, because you really got a game plan to go, wait, we got to stop from being overpowered up here. And then, of course, that compromises you in all the other areas, and that's where they're such a tough matchup, and that team is about as perfectly built as you're going to see a team in the salary cap era, and that's, you know, goes credit to Howie Roseman.
It is amazing, but it gets overlooked. When an offense is performing well, you focus on, just like we did with the Dolphins, four touchdowns from Raheem Mostert, four touchdowns from Devon Achane, although
Achane.
I saw a note yesterday. There's a change in the pronunciation. There's a new pronunciation for Achane. Once we all figured out it's Achane, and we spent a lot of time in the studio on Sunday making sure everybody knew it was Achane. There's a different, and I have to figure out exactly what it is, but I saw the note yesterday that he's got a new, which is fine. We want to respect that. We want to know what it is. But right. Once we figured out Achane, the goalpost moved. Anyway, we focus on those guys who score all the touchdowns, the quarterback that does the great things. But it's the offensive line that sets the stage for it. We're going to talk again about the Jets coming up. When you don't have an offensive line, everything goes to hell. And so that's the way football's always been. The offensive linemen go out there and they kick ass and nobody notices because everybody's noticing the work of all the other guys who benefit from the fact that the offensive line is kicking ass. Now,
yeah,
I do want to raise one thing about the quarterback push play. Peter and I talked about this 10 days ago, the day after the Vikings-Eagles game, where it's just automatic. They take advantage of the rule. It took 16 years for the unintended consequence to come to fruition. They allowed pushing players in 2006 because there used to be a rule against pushing and pulling. It was never enforced, even though there were constantly down, not constantly, but you'd see linemen come running down the field and just kind of shove everybody another yard or two at the end of a play. Eagles realize after 16 years, we can incorporate that into our basic strategy and build a quarterback sneak and enhance quarterback sneak around it because we'll just shove the guy through. Watch the third. If we have the one before that, Dallas Goedert is crossing the line from pushing to pulling. I noticed that on the third down play. He kind of wanted to maybe do it if necessary on the fourth down play, but the play before that when they tried to do it, I assume this is just the fourth down play over and over again, yeah, which isn't showing what I wanted to show, but it's on me because I didn't ask for it. I didn't ask for it ahead of time. On the third down play, you can see he's got his arms under Hurts and he's kind of doing like a wrestling
right
move.
I remember it.
Over the top. That's a foul. That's a foul.
They
that's
don't
pulling,
care.
Not pushing.
It's
well,
touchdown.
I know they
it's
don't
fantasy
care.
Fantasy points. It's everything. The NFL doesn't care. That's what.
But
we're,
why didn't they? Isn't it amazing? Usually, when you got a rule like that, everybody's doing it. When you have one team that's exploiting it, and no one else is either bothered or is willing to risk their, I don't know what it is. I don't know why no one else is doing it. I know a few others have tried.
Yeah, there's a few.
But
you
think there would be 24 owners who would say? But you would think there would be 24. I mean, 9 aren't doing it. So you do the math.
Yeah.
24 teams aren't doing it. Why don't they band together and say, let's get this thing the hell out of the game? It looks bad. It's not really football. And the only people who are loudly supporting it are Eagles fans.
Yeah. Well, it's unfortunately, you know, something that you talk about all the time. It's going to take somebody getting folded up and breaking a leg and doing all that until they finally realize this is not safe, right? This is not right. It's not. Or it's going to take...
And they act like we didn't know. We didn't know.
What do you mean? You didn't know. You try to stop these things from happening on special teams plays and all that where too many people are lined up over one guy or whatever else. We do know. So they that's what they'll try to say, but they know. And then, you know, the other thing that's going to stop it is, and which is like, if I was a defensive coach, I'd be going, go head hunting on the quarterback here. Go ahead. Let him have it. Dive over. Go crazy. Try to kill the quarterback. That's what I would do.
Okay.
I know. I don't mean it
first
like that.
First of all, yeah. I didn't say that.
No, I did. But I
didn't say that, first of all.
But here,
second of all, that's not what Chris means.
Yeah, I don't mean kill, but I mean just make them pay. Make them think twice about doing it. But the other aspect that is like, yeah, there's some teams doing it, Mike, but it's like they can't do it like them because of what we're talking about. It's the Cowboys of 92 here and then some. So they have a team that has a true advantage in this department, as compared to everybody else, where I don't think everybody else in football can just line up and do that to the capacity in which they do. And then you have Jalen Hurts, who's got a little more power than your normal quarterback on top of that.
Nick Sirianni addressed this over the weekend in a press conference. We get these transcripts in, and I skim them to see what stands out. And that caught my eye because, you know, his point is they don't even always push Jalen Hurts.
No.
It is basically a quarterback sneak with that enhancement if necessary, and sometimes he just slips through the crack. But what Sirianni said, and he rattled off the names of all his linemen, when you have this guy, when you have this guy, when you have this guy, that's – you know, that's why it works for us, because others have tried and it, you know, it hasn't been as successful as the Eagles do it. And it's almost like it's become a reputation play for the Eagles.
Yeah.
They had that one they tried during the game where it was clearly short, but this can't be short. It always works. They gave him the first down and good luck overturning it on replay review. You can never have clear and obvious evidence overturn the spot of the ball at a scrum of bodies like that. And so, yeah, hey, it always works. Let's give him the first down. Because when I saw the play, I thought, oh, they finally stopped it. It's like, what the hell? They're giving him the first down. Well, good luck overturning that one.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Everybody thinks it works. It does work. And nobody else has the horses to pull it off. And it starts with the offensive line. You need to have the quarterback. But these other teams that have that should at least consider it. But the other side of it is open season on the quarterback. And we don't mean that anyone should try to deliberately injure the quarterback. But when you forfeit all of the rules that apply to the protection of the quarterback, when you become a runner, there's only one rule that applies. You can't lower your head and initiate forcible contact with the quarterback. You can otherwise hit the quarterback anywhere. Forearm to the head, go low, go high. As long as you don't lower your helmet to initiate forcible contact, it's fine. And one of these days, a defense is going to come up with a way to take advantage of those rules and attack one of these plays like that, and the quarterback's going to get injured, and that team is going to think twice about doing it going forward, and it's going to be fuel for the NFL to get it out of the rule book. I'm surprised they didn't get rid of it after last year. I really am surprised. They're so worried about unintended consequences, I think it paralyzes them when there's something that it's obvious they need to do. They get all twisted up about what the unintended consequence is going to be. Instead of sitting down and talking it through with a room full of football people who can help you understand what the unintended consequence is going to be. This goes back to your point. When you got a bunch of non-football people making these rules, they can't figure out what the unintended consequences are going to be because they're in no position to imagine what they are.
No, they've never been around the game enough to know and think about the things that could happen, or, ooh, I saw this happen once at a practice or saw it in a game or whatever. And exactly right. And we got people that have none of those experiences going, hey, I might have figured it out for the league, even though I, you know, don't know it. And that's where that's got to change. There's a disconnect there. That's something wrong in football right now, for sure. You know, but yeah, the Eagles are great. They're hey, and if it ain't against the rules, I'd be like them too. I'd be doing that damn thing all the time as well. I understand it. You know, but we saw the Patriots master this for a while, the quarterback sneak with Brady, because there is a little bit of a skill from the quarterback and the guard and the center and even the tackles and how they do it, that there's a coachable skill to that and what they're doing on the offensive line, and the Eagles got it down, let alone they got, you know, the horses up front to make it happen. And that's where it's impressive. And then, you know, and really, you look at it and go, what defenses in football could really stop it? Their own and maybe the 49ers. That's like the only two teams you look at to go, okay, well, they maybe have a chance. Other than that, nobody else is going to be able to stop that crew and what they want to do in those situations.
Here's the play I was talking about earlier, which I didn't ask for. It is on me that we didn't have it earlier. But thanks to the control room, we have it now. Watch Goddard. Watch him. See that?
Arms, yeah, he's
up
trying.
The shoulder pads. That's pulling. That is a foul. And so, you know, this week when Troy Vincent and company send out their video and their memo to the officials, they need to point out when Goddard does that, it's a foul. That's not pushing. That's pulling. That's a foul. And they need to call it. Period. I mean, that's what the line is. You can push, but you can't pull. So if they're going to start pulling Jalen Hurts over the top, that's when they cross the line. And it needs to be called. And you know, maybe it's going to take more than one game for it to happen or more than one hack sounding off on it like me to get their attention. But as soon as I saw that last night, that's pulling, not pushing.
Yeah, no, it's definitely borderline there. But again, that's one where it's like the NFL, I don't think they're going to stop it unless it's like crazy egregious. I really don't. That's where the offense seems to get favored, definitely. But yeah, it was
a dominant. It's Juwan Taylor.
It was a dominant performance. They are some damn team. They really are, and they're tough, and they're mentally tough. They are, and then you throw on top of you get under the defensive side of the ball, and you go, damn, are you kidding me? They got Jalen Carter at pick 9. What? I mean, Jalen Carter's. He's arguably he's the best defensive player on their team already. He's the best defensive player on the field already, I think. That's what we're getting to. I mean, look at these plays that he busts through the line of scrimmage and pushed the pocket. I mean, he's taking 300-pound linemen and just going, now I'm going to take you right back to the quarterback, no problem. And then the next play, he can win with athleticism and hustle. So it's just incredible what the Eagles got, you know, on both sides of the ball. And then you add on Nolan Smith, who they got the end of the first round, and he had a few plays last night. You know, the Bucs couldn't run the ball. They had some chances early on, Mike. You know, that was their chances. Mike Evans dropped some passes early on, you know, early on in the football game that hurt them. It just took too long for them to get going. And it's when you play the Eagles, you got to be functioning at your best and at a very high level if you think you want to compete with that group.
Let's talk about Jalen Carter just for a second.
Yeah.
Because we all knew the guy was going to be great. These red flags were out there. And I'm not condoning in any way, shape, or form what he did. The drag racing, the speeding. He was involved in the incident that resulted in two people dying.
Right.
Had charges. That all hit when we were at the scouting combine. There was this nagging question of, does he love football? Will he show up and play every week? All that stuff we hear from time to time.
Yep.
8 teams had a shot at him.
Yeah.
Anyone else could have offered the Bears more than what the Eagles did to flip-flop 9 and 10. Because the Eagles at least realized, you know what? We better go ahead and
don't even take the chance. Right.
Because somebody else may be thinking, yeah, this is nuts. This guy's special. This guy's potentially dominant. Is it as simple as, because I think a lot of this happens when it comes to the draft. You're thinking, I really don't want to have to go sit in the owner's office and explain why we pissed away a top 10 pick on a guy who had these red flags and they came to fruition. So you need someone like Howie Roseman, who has full and complete equity and credibility with the owner, where he can get away with it. And if it turns out that Jalen Carter ends up being a bust, we at least did it consciously, and I'm not concerned that it's going to get me fired if I'm wrong. I think so many of these teams that have those high picks, and there's a guy there, and there's a red flag, you have people who are afraid that if the red flag starts flying, then the owner starts firing people, so we're just not going to do it.
Yeah.
Whereas I think now you're going to have some of these owners of some of these teams that were in the top 10 saying, what the f- – what was wrong with you?
Right.
What the hell?
Right.
Why didn't? Oh well, we have this and that. But look, I encourage open debate here, and you got to bring this to me, and you got to make this case. I got to know. Look, I got to balance this out. If I'm trading, you know, the opportunity to have generational talent against the possibility that he's not going to work out, I need to get a sense of how generational this talent's going to be before I say don't do it. So you're going to have some owners, I think, that are going back to their executives saying, why did you not stand on the table and jump up and down that I should go get Jalen Carter with this top 10 pick that we had?
Yeah. I think the first thing you said there, right? The cachet. Right, and that's Howie Roseman has that, right? He's got a lot of great picks, so he's granted a little bit more leash by the owner to make decisions like that. And then I think when you add on top of it going, wait, you know, and if it doesn't work out, oh, I still got 7 other all-stars on my defensive line, so we'll be okay. So they could afford to kind of take that gamble. Where I think it fell right for them is, one, some of the horror stories, and then you had teams in front of them in this year that – they needed a guy that they knew was going to work or going to work, and we can't risk, you know, the off the field, is he going to play hard type of stuff. And they got lucky that way, you know. But as you heard me say very early on in the draft process, right? I mean, he was the best player in the draft. And that's where, you know, like you're saying right now, the owners are going to be a little bit, some of these owners are going to be like, damn, how did we, you know, not think about that more seriously, whatever it may be. But he's phenomenal. He's like he's a new age Warren Sapp to me. That's what I feel like I'm looking at. Like, it's like Warren Sapp evolution 25 years later. He's a little bigger, a little more powerful, right? And has that athletic ability and the bendability. And it's truly special. And then when you couple that with all the damn players they got there on that football team, like, holy crap, it's a really good defensive line.
I'm looking at the picks ahead of Jalen Carter, and we don't know how these guys are going to work out. They all may be superstars. We don't know. But here's the thing. I'm sorry to pile on the Bears after they've had one of the worst weeks we've ever seen. Why didn't they just take him at 9?
Well, that's
why didn't they just take him?
That is a course. I mean, yeah, they don't have a they
forget
don't have
whatever the Eagles gave him to flip flop. Take Jalen Carter at 9.
I know. I think there's pressure of the O line, and I'm guessing they're not sure about the character of Jalen Carter. But yes, I mean, you look at them and go, that is a team that is in desperate need of a difference maker on the D-line, you know. And again, hey, who knows? Maybe it wouldn't have worked out quite the same way at all the other places. Like we said during the draft process,
true.
The Eagles, right, with the Georgia guys, the environment, Fletcher Cox. He's got a lot of things there to push him in the right direction. And, of course, that helped Howie Roseman sell that to ownership or whoever he needed to, you know, to make this work too.
It's pretty good, though, when a luxury pick ends up becoming a foundational piece of your team.
It's unbelievable.
For years to come.
Yes.
We're going to take a break. 3 weeks in, some teams are not hiding their frustrations with their slow starts. Who can turn it around? We'll discuss that next here on PFT Live.
I won't let my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. In 2 clinical studies, Tremfya guselkumab, taken by injection, provided 90% clear skin at 16 weeks in 7 out of 10 adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. In a study, nearly 7 out of 10 patients with 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks were still clearer at 5 years. At 1 year and thereafter, patients and healthcare providers knew that Tremfya was being used. This may have increased results. Results may vary.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.